Adventures with Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. For your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible. I still remember the day my father took me to the Cemetery of Forgotten Books for the first time. It was the early summer of 1945, and we walked through the streets of a Barcelona trapped beneath ashen skies as dawn poured over Rambla de Santa Monica in a wreath of liquid copper.
Hello, welcome to Adventures with Words, where we explore storytelling in all its forms. I'm Rob.
I'm Kate.
And as you might have noticed from that short introduction, this week we are talking about Barcelona, where we recently were lucky enough to go on holiday. And it's more of a cultural tour of the city that we're doing this week.
Yeah, we thought it would be a nice way to explore Barcelona by looking at some of the things that have been written about it, things that have been set there, and talk a little bit about what we found in those places when we went there ourselves.
So opening extract that you read was from The Shadow of the Wind that we talked about last week.
Yeah, by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. And that's the very opening passage of the book, which then sort of also links to his other Barcelona gothic thriller novels.
So it talks about the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, and Daniel grows up working in a bookshop. So you and I did go there.
We did.
Had a wander around. Unfortunately, we didn't find any of the sites mentioned in the book.
Sadly, number 9 on La Rambla is no longer in existence. The Church of Santa Monica, which is mentioned there, has actually now been extended. It's a sort of art gallery, sort of art and culture centre. And the block stops at number 11. So we got as close to it as we possibly could. And then the church, the art centre is number 7. So we tried our best to find it, but unfortunately it's no longer there, if it ever was.
We did say if you're a canny businessman, you should open up a bookshop there.
Yeah.
Probably make a killing.
Definitely. But yeah, so we visited La Rambla. That was one of the first places that we went to in Barcelona. And it's mentioned quite a number of times by different people as being a really important part of Barcelona. When you go there, you can see that it's sort of almost summing up the city. As you walk along, you have the theatres, the food markets, sort of street traders, the very famous flower sellers, and it takes you right from the heart of the city with lots of kind of Gaudi architecture and expensive shops right down to the sea.
Yes, you've got Columbus at the end looking out to sea,
yeah,
the giant statue. And it's sort of a main thoroughfare. It's a main sort of pedestrianised road. We've got shops. I mean, especially at night, it became quite a lively place, quite a fun
Definitely.
Place to be.
Yeah. And on one side of it, you've got the more sort of respectable, sort of older buildings. But then on the other side, the really, really ancient kind of Gothic quarter and sort of medieval city and tiny winding little streets taking you to the old cathedral. And it's really lively, lots of sort of shops and bars and tourists, but also people just out for the evening. It's a really interesting place.
Well, one of the most famous books about Barcelona and the area in general is Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell when he was there during the Civil War.
I had come to Spain with some notion of writing newspaper articles, but I'd joined the militia almost immediately because at that time and in that atmosphere it seemed the only conceivable thing to do. The anarchists were still in virtual control of Catalonia, and the revolution was still in full swing. To anyone who had been there since the beginning, it probably seemed, even in December or January, that the revolutionary period was ending. But when one came straight from England, the aspect of Barcelona was something startling and overwhelming. It was the first time that I had ever been in a town where the working class was in the saddle. Practically every building of any size had been seized by the workers, and was draped with red flags or with the red and black flag of the anarchists. Every wall was scrawled with a hammer and sickle and with the initials of the revolutionary parties. Almost every church had been gutted and its images burnt. Churches here and there were being systematically demolished by gangs of workmen. Every shop and cafe had an inscription saying that it had been collectivised. Even the bootblacks had been collectivised and their boxes painted red and black. Waiters and shop workers looked you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had temporarily disappeared. No one said, Señor, or Don, or even Usted. Everyone called everyone else comrade and thou and said salut instead of buenos dias. Tipping was forbidden by law since the time of Primo de Rivera. Almost my first experience was receiving a lecture from a hotel manager for trying to tip a lift boy. There were no private motor cars, they'd all been commandeered, and all the trams and taxis and much of the other transport were painted red and black. The revolutionary posters were everywhere, flaming from the walls in clean reds and blues that made the few remaining advertisements look like daubs of mud. Down the Ramblas, the wide central artery of the town, where crowds of people streamed constantly to and fro, the loudspeakers were bellowing revolutionary songs all day and far into the night. And it was the aspect of the crowds that was the queerest thing of all. In outward appearance, it was a town in which the wealthy classes had practically ceased to exist. Except for a small number of women and foreigners, there were no well-dressed people at all. Practically everyone wore rough, working-class clothes, or blue overalls, or some variant of the militia uniform. All this was queer and moving. There was much in it that I did not understand. In some ways, I did not even like it, but I recognised it immediately as a state of affairs worth fighting for. Also, I believed that things were as they appeared, that this was really a worker state, and that the entire bourgeoisie had either fled, been killed, or voluntarily come over to the workers' side. I did not realise that great numbers of well-to-do bourgeois were simply lying low and disguising themselves as proletarians for the time being.
That was George Orwell there talking about his early experiences of Barcelona during the Civil War. It was quite interesting that when we were there, I did spot a few posters for independence for Catalonia.
Yeah, and one of the times when we were walking on La Rambla, there was a sort of couple of people sitting at a table with T-shirts with sort of independent slogans and so on.
So it's an issue that's, even to this day, it still hasn't gone away. I believe they're trying to do a vote for independence shortly. It's an interesting topic.
Yeah, I think it's got such a strong identity of its own. It's no wonder that it feels that it is kind of its own place. And I think, you know, as soon as you arrive there, there is definitely a feeling of being in Barcelona rather than anywhere else.
Well, signs, they're written first in Catalan, then they're in Spanish, and quite handily they're then written in English underneath. But
yeah, it was interesting.
The way that Catalan and the Spanish, there's a strong identity there that we both picked up on.
And I think a lot of the things that we know, you know, in terms of the architecture, the artwork, the shops, everyone was very proud to be from Barcelona, to be Catalan, to have that sort of aspect of it was, you know, that there's a something, I don't know, I suppose like French would say je ne sais quoi, whatever,
yes.
You know, but there's something that is just Catalan about the place. And, you know, not being a wide traveller in Spain, but there was certainly something about it which was really unique, I thought.
So Orwell's talking about the Civil War. I think he wrote it came out in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
If we go forward to Shadow of the Wind, which is set after the Civil War,
yeah,
we can see that, well, things have certainly changed.
Yeah, because obviously the anarchists weren't successful in the end. And I guess, you know, it covers in The Shadow of the Wind that you had that group of people and they, you know, they were really looking for equality. They were trying to sweep away the old hierarchies and to create something a bit more egalitarian. And ultimately they weren't really successful. And you had Franco coming in, the sort of fascist regime. And this is how we get to that point, isn't it? Where someone like Fumero has been able to rise to prominence and, well, or if not fame in terms of prominence, then certainly a lot of power. People like, Fermin ending up being in big, you know, ending up basically a tramp, having been part of, the attempt to create something a bit better.
So if we talk a little bit about the geography of Barcelona, it's sort of in a natural sort of dip, a natural bowl, with surrounded by mountains on either side,
which
you can see as you're flying in. But overlooking all of Barcelona, looking down on it, is Montjuïc Castle, which you went up to visit, which is rather, it's rather imposing.
Yeah, it certainly is. I became a persecuted criminal, and my superiors were forced to hide like rats. Naturally, Fumero was already in charge of the clean-up operation. The purge was carried out openly, with shootings in the streets or in Montjuïc Castle. I was arrested in the port while attempting to obtain passage to France on a Greek cargo ship for some of my superiors. I was taken to Montjuic and held for 2 days in a pitch dark cell with no water or ventilation. The next light I saw was the flame of a welding torch.
That was Fermin there in the Shadow of the Wind, talking about being captured by Fumero. So he went up to Montjuic Castle, which looks down upon the sea and also on Barcelona.
Yeah.
He went into these cells where a sort of unspeakable acts took place. And it's a creepy place when you knew what happened there.
It was. I think having read Shadow of the Wind, it does add a sort of an extra frisson because you feel as if you know the people who ended up there. But I mean, it's a very imposing place. It's this big sort of 1700s type fort.
It's not really a castle. Well, not how we...
No. Castle. So yeah, no. Yeah. It's, I mean, we imagine a castle like kind of a medieval thing, and it's much much newer than that. There used to be the lookout tower there, and there would be sort of a signalling to the ships. But then it was all rebuilt. But it's very much the in theory it's kind of protecting Barcelona from an attack by the sea. But in fact, the guns up there could easily fire on any part of the city. And we went and we were reading some of the information boards. And in fact, I think it was only ever used once in protection of the city. And the rest of the time, it was actually kind of subjugating the city. You know, it was a point of control over the people of Barcelona and more of a threat than anything else. And then during the Civil War, it was used as a base, you know, as a prison. It's really quite creepy to be there knowing what had happened there.
And when you're down on the streets, you can look up almost from anywhere and you can see there in the mountains, there's Montjuic. And in the Shadow of the Wind, there is this fear that you're always being watched by the police.
Yeah.
And
absolutely. It does look right, you know, when we were up there, you could see right over the whole kind of curve along the coast and back out. You know, as the city goes inland, you've got this amazing vantage point. You could see, and yeah, I think you would get that feeling of being overlooked all the time, you know, like you were being watched, your actions were being watched.
So on our way up to Montjuic Castle, we did walk through the Olympic Park, which is where the Olympics were in 1992. We found that quite funny because there's all these outdoor escalators everywhere.
Yeah, that was really quite odd. We sort of started right at the base of the hill. We sort of looked up in our Lonely Planet guide, you know, this is the way to go up there. And we sort of started you know, standing between these two tall towers, looking right up, you know, past the Museum of Art and Culture. But yeah, as you go up at each stage, there's all these escalators going up the hill. It's such an odd experience. You know, it was really practical actually because it's quite a tall hill. But it meant you got quite far up without really doing much walking. It was quite strange.
We're more used to indoor escalators at the underground, whatever. But these are, you've got the sky above you.
Yeah.
I don't know what happens when it rains.
It was quite an odd experience. And in Montjuic itself, now there's the hill rather than the castle, is a real cultural centre. Mm. You know, as I said, you've got the National Museum of Art and Culture there. You've got lots of other galleries and museums, as well as the Olympic Park. You know, we popped into look at some art on our way, and we also went into the Olympic Museum which was quite fun, apart from an unfortunate Lance Armstrong exhibition.
Oh, yes but it was nice to walk around the Olympic Park because you could literally just walk in and also compare it to our own. I mean, you went, you know, we've just hosted the Olympics, you went to the new Olympic Park.
Yeah, it was quite odd. Yeah, having not long been to the you know, London 2012 Olympic Park, going to the stadium in Stratford, how teeny tiny the stadium in Barcelona seemed in comparison. Although it does have a blue running track, and my sister assures me that that's very cool.
Oh, right, yes.
Yeah, apparently so.
Now, the Olympic Park in Barcelona is apparently also features in a murder mystery book featuring one of Spain's most famous fictional detectives, Pepe Carvalho, who's the protagonist of a number of novels written by Manuel Vasquez Montalban, who passed away in 2003. And it's an Olympic death featuring a murder on the Olympic site in 1992 whilst it was being built. Montalban was known as a poet, a playwright, an essayist, and he wrote on anything from food, sociology, and politics. Montalban was quite well known, had quite a lot of acclaim. He won the Planeta Prize, which is basically the Spanish equivalent of our Booker Prize in 1979, and then went on to win the Grand Prix of Detective Fiction in France in 1981. Pepe Carvalho was known, very fond of his food, and Barcelona itself became a character within the stories. It was described as a great noir city, and rather lovingly realised lots of places, it tells you lots of places to go and eat, a lot of art, a lot of culture. But he was using Barcelona to reflect upon Spanish society as a whole and the changes that was going through at the time.
I mean, obviously, this isn't either of our specialist subject. It's something that we kind of came across because we were wondering what other stories were going on. But it sounds to me like, you know, that's very much part of the kind of trend which, you know, people are obsessed with Scandi crime at the moment, you know, or well, certainly there has been a big trend in that in the last couple of years. And it was supposed to be this big thing that, you know, it started off with Martin Beck, this kind of social commentary. But it obviously hasn't just been restricted to cold crime, using detective stories to pick up on social issues. You've got Inspector Montalbano, slightly confusingly, you know, and that's set in Sicily, and the writer there is doing a very similar thing. And a lot of what he picks up on is actually the difficulty of getting anything done in that climate where, it, you know, certainly in the past, it was so influenced by the mafia. And so, you know, this is the similar sort of thing with Pepe Carvalho, that he's picking up on various issues in Spanish society. So I don't know, I was quite intrigued by that. I think I might see if I can give that a go, because I've I read a lot about detectives in the snow, but rarely anywhere else.
Different climate, How long do you think till someone writes Murder at Stratford for our Olympics?
Well, there were all sorts of strange rumours about that, actually. I saw the most bizarre video on YouTube where someone was arguing that the entire building of the new Olympic Park was down to Templar Knights and linking it in with the Da Vinci Code.
Of course,
so, I mean, if you want to tell a story, you'll find a way to tell it.
So west of the city, more inland than Montjuïc Mountain, is a but more pleasant, relaxed area, which is Tibidabo.
I thanked him for the information and was about to turn down the avenue when I looked up and saw Tibidabo Mountain awakening behind the gauzy clouds. Suddenly, I felt like taking the funicular up the hill to visit the old amusement park crowning its top and wander among its merry-go-rounds and the eerie automaton halls. But I promised to be back at the bookshop on time.
That was Daniel again from Shadow of the Wind. So we did take that journey. We went up the funicular.
We did, although there was a stop just before that, because, of course, the Aldaya House, the Angel of Mists, where everything, well, where a lot of the kind of spooky happenings of The Shadow of the Wind take place, is on Avenue Tibidabo, which is the main road up towards the mountain. And we did go and have a look. And we did find the right number. It was
house.
The number was actually there. It's not a big spooky house with a fountain and lots of statues of angels, though, which is a bit disappointing.
It's quite small. The Chinese embassy next door is a bit more impressive, if you can see
that
the fences.
That was terrifying. I couldn't think what on earth it was until we saw the sign that said it was the Chinese embassy. But that was quite impressive. But sadly, no Angel of the Mist house.
But then we moved our way up the mountain. It was on the funicular, which is, I don't think I'd ever quite been on one before.
That was quite good fun.
And then it was up to Tibidabo.
Yeah, it's the most incredible views. It's taller than Montjuic. It's you know, proper mountains, very, very tall. And then up there is still the merry-go-round that Daniel mentions. There is still a hall of automatons, which we went and looked around. You don't have to put a coin in each one to make it work anymore. You just have to press a button.
But some of them were a bit eerie, a bit creepy.
Yeah, there were some really quite creepy ones. There was a French Revolution automaton which chops the person's head off with a guillotine.
Some hangings.
Oh my god!
Yeah,
that was quite grim. Oh dear!
Have you ever seen the film Big? There's an automaton a bit similar to that.
Oh yes, the fortune teller.
The fortune teller. Yeah. There's also some nice recreations, models of the actual area itself, which gives you more of a picture of where you are. the funicular coming up, the mountain, the amusement park.
That was lovely, actually, yeah. Particularly the one where you could, the rides would go round, you could see the big wheel turning, and there's this amazing ride, which I guess is far too new for it to be there when Daniel went there, but with a sort of an aeroplane going round, but where the aeroplane goes round, it goes right sort of over the edge, so you've got this massive drop below you.
Yeah, Tibidabo, it did have a sort of a more nostalgic feel, the whole place.
Yeah, it did.
The rest of Barcelona. I really liked it up there.
It was good fun, actually. And I think it's kind of a shame that the time which we went, it closed quite early, obviously, because it gets dark quite early. The last funicular, we were just in time for it. So we got the final funicular back down and then caught a bus back into the main part of Barcelona.
Now, one thing that you can see, you know, from Montjuic and from Tibidabo, it was more of a point of reference for us.
Yeah.
Was the Sagrada Familia, which is just, well, we thought it was absolutely stunning. Or, well, perhaps not quite so complimentary.
For the first time since I'd been in Barcelona, I went to have a look at the cathedral, a modern cathedral, and one of the most hideous buildings in the world. It has four crenellated spires exactly the shape of hock bottles. Unlike most of the churches in Barcelona, it was not damaged during the revolution. It was spared because of its artistic value, people said. I think the anarchists showed bad taste in not blowing it up when they had the chance, though they did hang a red and black banner between its spires.
So we must say that the Sagrada Familia, what it looked like then, for Orwell, must have been quite different to what we saw.
Yeah, it's been in constant state of building and growing and changing since, it must be, it's over 100 years now, isn't
it? Yes, yeah. And they've still got another 15, 20 years to go,
yeah.
An estimate?
We looked at a model outside which showed you in one colour what had already been built and then in another colour what was still left to go. And to me, it looked like there was at least another third again still to be added in terms of these enormous spires. We again read something as we were going round which said that the tallest spire, the central spire, will itself be as tall as Montjuic.
Which is just, well, it's mind-boggling. I mean, so this is designed by Gaudi. Mm-hmm. You can't really go far in Barcelona without seeing a lot of his work.
No, I mean, he really is ever-present. And I think when we first arrived, we stayed very close to the Sagrada Familia. And so we got off, one of the first things we saw when we sort of got off the metro was this incredible construction. And I think at first we just thought, it was a bit strange, a bit quirky.
From a distance, it sort of, it just looks like a cathedral. But it's just as you sort of get closer to it and you start to pay a bit more attention and you notice, well, it's got very unique features. The outside or the four sides are telling a number of stories, the Easter story, the Nativity. But I don't think, for me, it wasn't until I got inside and you're looking up and you think, well, okay, there's the church and there's sort of columns, but it's like there's trees inside, the way he's designed it, the columns sort of divide up. I mean, it was absolutely astonishing.
It's very beautiful. I think it's very intelligent and very beautiful, which is a great combination. I think the thing that really struck me, actually, when we went inside, having looked at the Passion facade, which, you know, as you say, it's the Easter story, it's very harsh lines. The people are not kind of realistic, they're quite stylized. It's very hard, very sad. And then the doors that there is, it's not what's supposed to be eventually the main doors, but the doors that you go in on that side then take you in, and you are just then bathed in this rainbow of light coming through the stained glass. It was absolutely breathtaking. It was so beautiful. And then I think it works because then as you look round, there aren't that many colours. Yeah. Actually, it's very much sort of shades of white and beige. It's actually very plain, most of it. And then you've just got these astonishing stained glass windows. And the stained glass, it's not, I mean, I think most places in Britain where you get stained glass, it's got pictures in it. It's people or saints or, you know, whatever it is, or words.
There was a water stained glass window That's more the blues. It was,
yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely astonishing. And then as you walk through, so you've seen the Passion Facade, that's the more modern side.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, Gaudi wanted every generation to add something to the cathedral. So we saw the modern part, I suppose our generation.
Yeah.
As you walk through and then out and you watch the Nativity, that was his. That's possibly more classically designed.
Yeah, but then I think what it was implying, certainly, we had these incredibly detailed audio guides to listen to as we went around. What that was kind of implying was that the Nativity side was deliberately kind of softer, more realistic, because that was a more kind of everyday, you know, babies are born every day and it's something that everyone can relate to, with the, you know, a mum and a dad and the difficulties of being parents and this kind of thing. And you could see all the, it was covered in kind of plants and animals and leaves and flowers and buds and all these sort of things, you know, and the shepherds with little lambs and whatnot, and, you know, and it was very sweet and friendly. It's a complete contrast to the opposite side of the building. But I mean, yeah, I don't know how much of that is the fact that they're putting that spin on it, that times have changed and styles have changed, or it really was how he always intended it to be, that it would be a very different, you know, a very kind of drastic style in comparison to the Nativity. I mean, we can't tell, can we?
I found it astonishing that he started this project knowing full well he was never going to see it through to the end, just because that's how long it took.
Yeah, he knew it would take 100 years, and that was always part of the plan. And he obviously left such detailed sketches and drawings and plans so that people could keep going.
I mean, we were there and work is still carrying on.
Yeah, as we were looking around, there were people there kind of building things and sculpting things and adding more on. I think, you know, now they're still doing bits and bobs on the Passion Facade, but I think obviously the Nativity Facade has all been done for quite a long time. The side of the church behind where the altar is, that's pretty much done. And it's the remaining side that has really not got much done to it at all. It's kind of all covered in scaffolding, but that's going to be where there's going to be writing kind of floating on. It's supposed to look like it's floating on clouds that will be all over that far end. And then that's what you'll walk in through into the main bit of the cathedral. It just sounds astonishing to me. I mean, if it's as stunning as the inside is, it will just look amazing.
Oh, I feel very lucky that we've been to see it when it hasn't been completed, because we both said we want to go back when it's finished to see how it's
definitely
developed. You also went to see some more Gaudi and found out he's a bit of a Jules Verne fan. In one of the buildings that he was commissioned to renovate, which is that was off the Rambler?
It's a little way along. It's on the Passage de Gracia.
That's the Casa Bio.
Yeah.
Which, if you standing from the outside, it's a surreal experience.
It's quite crazy.
You're in essentially in a high street. There's shops, cars going past, and then there's this sort of weird out of this world building, which is, you feel like you're almost just stepping underwater.
It's all kind of curved, almost like it's sort of slightly distorted, you know, where you look through that kind of wavy glass and everything looks a bit wavy through. It's kind of like that, just looking at the building, the way that there aren't really any completely straight lines apart from where the building meets the other ones either side of it. It's quite an odd experience, actually.
Yes, there's lots of sort of stained glass that's all curved. So the light's being constantly distorted.
Yeah.
And that was just strange, just to step on, especially when you walk out back onto the street again.
Yeah, definitely. And you're looking across, and when we were there, they're kind of redoing the entrance to the metro opposite. So you just got these sort of metal hoardings and whatnot. And then you turn around and it's there behind you. It was quite amazing, actually. And I think that was when I went from thinking it was just kind of a bit of a novelty to thinking that actually this guy is a bit of a genius. You know, when we went in and then you kind of walk around the house, that was a bit odd. It was very busy despite it being January. But I think even so, it was really interesting looking at all these different little touches that he'd put in, even the things like kind of making the mechanism to open the windows on this big long window, making them visible, but also that they look nice, you know, just sort of like celebrating the craftsmanship of it.
Yeah, the windows slid up and down. There was no hinges like you'd expect in a normal house, so that you could get almost an unbroken view looking out Yeah, I found it fascinating. I was a bit like you when I went in. I thought, well, yeah, he's just being a bit quirky, you know, ahead of his time. But by the end of it, I came out and I thought he was an absolute genius.
I mean, things like the way that it was ventilated, you know, these houses, these blocks have these big light wells, and he'd used, you know, the different colored tiling. There was, they called it a chromatographic scheme. Is that right? Where the tiling in the light well was a different color depending on how far up and down you went. The higher you got up the light well, the darker the tiles were, so that it gave the impression when the light shone in of the same color from the top to the bottom. And it also meant that the light wasn't too glaring as it came in. And then, you know, we went up kind of into the attics, into the servant quarters, and there's no air conditioning or anything like that in this house. But actually what we found was there were these gaps where the wind could always blow through. Mm. So actually, even in January, it was just right. It was just the right temperature. It wasn't too warm, wasn't too cold. And then, you know, like we were up on the, you can get right up on the roof. We were looking down, and even just next to the glass on the outside on the roof, which then goes into the light well, the tiles have pictures of butterflies on them. Mm. It's like beautiful tessellating pattern. And, you know, who's going to look there, really? When you're designing a house, who takes time to think about using a pattern tile on the roof where no one can see? But he, I don't know, I think it's just those little touches that really made me think, this is so beautiful. You know, it's really thoughtful, the way that it's been put together.
Well, I hope you enjoyed our brief cultural guides to Barcelona as a city. I must say, having read The Shadow of the Wind before we went, I think it does give you a different perspective, a different spin on the city than something, say, like a guidebook would do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we went out and we hunted, trying to hunt down as many places as we could with a fairly good success rate. But I'm definitely looking forward to going back and exploring a bit more of Barcelona, the old and the new, because I think there's definitely a divide between what's new, and then as you walk through the back streets, you get quite a feel for the city there.
It's a fascinating mix, and yeah, like you say, I'm really looking forward to going back and finding out a bit more.
If you'd like to see some of the pictures that we took while we're out there, I'll put a link to my Flickr feed in the notes. If you'd like to get in touch, let us know what you thought. You can contact us on Twitter. We're @WordAdventures. You can send us an email, contact@adventureswithwords.com. And you can also like our page on Facebook.
In 2 weeks' time, it's another of our Book Plate book group reads. We'll be talking about Wolf Hall, as you know. But so just a reminder, you've still got a little while. If you haven't quite got to the end of it, you've still got a little while longer to finish that book and then hear our conversation about it. Next week, we'll just be letting you know what we've got coming up on our reading list, what we're looking forward to. So we'll see you then. I've been Kate.
I've been Rob, and thanks for listening.
Adventures with Words is brought to you by Audible. Try Audible free for 30 days and download any audiobook for free. For your free trial, go to www.adventureswithwords.com/audible.